My guest in the studio grew up in Adelaide. He studied at the South Australian Conservatorium of Music. He worked in R&B bands around Australia during the 1980s and then spent 18 years in London working with artists such as Eric Clapton, Sting, B.B. King, Van Morrison and a five-year stint with Jules Holland. He led his own jazz funk groups in London and worked with artists such as Jim Mullen, John Etheridge and Carl Orr. He currently works in around eight bands here in Australia and is about to release the third album from his own abiding band, Hammerhead. Following up on previous releases from Hammerhead, Mosaic and Turning Point. Jason Brewer, welcome to Now's the Time. Welcome back to Now's the Time,
Thank I should say. Thank you. Very nice to be here, Frank.
It's been over 5 years since we last spoke on Now's the Time, since you were here on the hot seat. Back then, we learned a lot about your early musical influences, such as Pink Floyd and Weather Report, John Coltrane, Wayne Shorter, Eddie Harris. Can you please briefly remind our listener how you came to love music and interested in the saxophone?
Well, I was a bit of a late starter. I had a year in London when I was 16. My father was over there doing his masters and, I was a bit too young to stay back in Australia. So apart from my older brother, Tim, who, you're familiar with, we all moved over there with him. I wasn't a musician at this point. I hadn't really, I had a drum kit for 6 months when I was a kid to let off steam, but I hadn't really applied myself to anything. I became friends with a guy that was 2 or 3 years older than me who was into jazz. And he, we used to sit around in his bedroom listening to John Coltrane and Bobby Hutcherson and Weather Report. He was just filling my ears with all of this crazy stuff that I'd never heard before. I was always a big fan of the saxophone from Pink Floyd and some Rolling Stones. Even, for that year that I was in London, the penny hadn't really dropped, but he was introducing me to this music and he'd take me to jazz clubs. And I remember seeing Bobby Hutcherson live at Ronnie Scott's, just going, what is going on? I was really intrigued without really understanding what was happening. I mean, I knew that there was sort of improvising going on and all the stuff because of, my interest in rock and blues and stuff, where that was also a feature of that music. And then I moved back to Australia in 77. A bunch of friends of mine who I went to school with had sort of recently started playing instruments and were kind of jamming with some other people that they'd met. And I used to go along to these jam sessions and just sort of sit there in the rehearsal room just watching these guys think, wow, this is pretty cool. And then a year later, the penny dropped and I thought, right, well, I'm not interested in doing anything else, so maybe music's for me. So I went and hired a saxophone, and within about 3 months the guy said, look, do you want to join the band? I could barely pick the thing up, let alone play it. Sounded pretty terrible, but they obviously saw something in me that made them have faith,
encouraged me.
And look, that band that went on to be a sort of really progressive sort of art rock jazz band, which Tim was also in at one point in the latter incarnation of that band, was a band called Cottage. And the main guys in that band that wrote the music, if I had to sort of name a couple of biggest influences in my life, then those two guys would be it, because they were just freaks in my mind, the way they played at such a young age. And like, they were very patient with me and sort of, obviously I was practicing like a maniac at that stage.
Well, you were practicing 8 or 9 hours a day.
Correct. Yeah. Well, I was 18 and a half and I had never finished school, and I just became so completely transfixed by this music bug, that it didn't take long for me to think, right, I want to do a degree in performing arts. How can I do that? Because I didn't have the equivalent of HSC. It's called matriculation in South Australia. I thought, well, if I practice 8 or 9 hours a day for 3 years, then maybe I can audition and get in as a mature age student, and then that's what I did. And interestingly, it coincided with not only my older brother Tim enrolling in the Bachelor of Music in the same intake, but my sister, who'd played violin all her life and was, you know, was quite a few years younger than me, she finished her, you know, matriculation, and the obvious thing for her to do was just do a music degree. So there we were, the three of us, in 1982.
Egging each other on at the SA Conservatory.
Yeah, and we're in some of the same classes, and, you know, Hillary was just streets ahead of me and, you know, blitzing oral training and all of that stuff, which I barely scraped through on. But and look, I met some of my closest friends till this day who I still see from that period of my life, 1982 to 1984, and then I came up to Sydney.
Now, as I mentioned, you went back to London after establishing yourself here in Australia with Fat Time.
Correct.
It was almost a household name, you know.
Almost,
I mean, you played a lot of television.
Yeah.
You went to lots of concerts when you first went to London, but you established quite a career over there, and I mentioned all those great artists that you shared stages with during that period of time. Now, there must have been so many highlights, but can you perhaps name one or two and just describe what sort of impact it made on you?
It was, it was sort of, I had to pinch myself sometimes. A lot of those big acts I played with when I was with Jules Holland's band, in his band, because he was already a kind of, you know, extremely well known from his stint with UK Squeeze. And also he had him and Paula Yates actually had a show on Channel 4 when that started in the mid 80s. I can't remember what it was called. It was like a, you know, music sort of chat show. So he was already really well known. So the exposure that I got through him and playing with some of the artists that he sort of had guesting with him on various TV programs was, it was incredible. I think probably the most exciting one, I mean, there's many, was we got booked to play at Sting's, I think it was his 10th wedding anniversary, at his house.
Wow.
Right? This medieval house in Wiltshire, right? And that was surreal enough, because there we were, and they hadn't really, they hadn't thought about a band room. And that was the first thing that was odd. So we drove up through this vast property. You know, we were given directions. This was before GPS. So we all have got A to Zs on our laps trying to find this gate on, you know, in this massive, obscure kind of property. And we found this gate, which took us past the famous lake, because he's got a studio, Lakeside Studios, right? We eventually made our way to this massive medieval kind of mansion. And they went, we didn't think about that. Oh, just use the kitchen. You guys can just use the kitchen. So there we all sitting around this massive table in Sting's kitchen, and all sort of like making every excuse under the sun to sort of rush off and find the bathroom and sort of explore the house and opening doors and looking in, you know, all of these kind of libraries. And he had this massive room with sort of, you know, vintage books and a grand piano and a big open fire. It was quite extraordinary. But
and here's you thinking all the time, is Branford Marsalis going to turn up or not?
Well, actually, he wasn't. Branford had stopped working with him at that point.
Right.
But the sort of the highlight of the night was we did a set, and then, you know, Sting got up and did something for Trudy, his wife. And then, like, all of these celebrities were there. Like, there wasn't anybody that wasn't an A-lister. Like, there was Dustin Hoffman, there was Tom Hanks, all of these A-list American movie stars who would Concorde it over for the weekend. Like, literally, Concorde was still flying in those days. And at one point, I looked around and Eric Clapton had got up playing guitar. His bassist, Nathan East, was playing bass. Michael Waldron was there, who was playing drums, the great producer that played with Mahavishnu Orchestra. And then Stevie Winwood got on the organ, which Jules' brother vacated. And the next thing we know, we're playing Gimme Some Loving. And nobody really in the horn section, apart from me and the trumpet player, kind of knew the lines to play. So we were sort of like, you know, telling the guys what to play. And there was, you know, Dustin Hoffman with his kids dancing on the dance floor. It was next level, what is going on. Yeah, so that's got to be one of the highlights.
No doubt, yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a few, but that I reckon, if I had to pick one, that was extraordinary. You know, Billy Connolly was there, Alan Rickman, you know, extraordinary.
Incredible. I'm speaking with Jason Brewer tonight here on Now's the Time. We're talking jazz called The Yearning, and it was written for your late mother, Biddy. Now, this composition and the arrangement, I guess it stands apart on this album because it has a different kind of intensity, a soulful intensity, I think. Can you tell us what you were aiming for on this piece?
It's a good question, actually. Look, I wanted it to me, and maybe it's just personal, but, you know, I'm really delighted that you picked it off the album to play. Has, you know, quite a strong narrative for me. The sort of the main section is in a major key. It's quite diatonic. And then there's those sort of little kind of strange interludes that are sort of quite ambiguous in terms of the harmony. But then in the solo, which is just a piano solo, we wanted to keep it simple. It goes into a minor key, which was the way I tried to express my grief, you know, going from a major to a minor. It's like a parallel minor. I think that came across quite well. I mean, I put a lot into that composition, and I sort of, you know, when I listen to it, I think it, you know, the narrative is quite strong to me. Obviously, anybody else listening to it wouldn't feel the way I feel because, you know, it's connected to my grief after my mother died. But I don't know if that answers your question. But yeah, so the idea of it was to sort of, you know, for there to be an intensity because, you know, it's rare that grief, you know, is anything other than intense.
That's right.
You know, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it certainly achieves that. But the lineage of Hammerhead goes back to, I think, what, 2012?
I think earlier, actually. Earlier, I think maybe 2011, 2010, yeah, possibly.
It came out of the hard bop tradition, you know, the Blue Note sound of the 50s and 60s. But it's grown to be sort of the epitome of your intensity and fluid sound on the saxophone. And that's partly and perhaps due to your involvement with a broad array of musical genres, other projects that you're involved with that cross over to soul and funk and blues, and that perhaps seeps through into both your writing and your playing. You call it, I think, urban jazz, but it's really Jason Brewer jazz, isn't it?
Well, I'm very happy for you to call it that. I mean, I think urban jazz is one of those kind of slightly trendy ways of describing something that is, you know, today, you know. Mm. I think it's a sort of
relevant today.
Yeah, it's a label that came out of New York. You know, it's, I mean, at the end of the day, it's, you know, modern contemporary jazz, you know. Mm. You know, there's any number of ways you could call it. But I still think, like, even though it's more today than, say, the first album, was very much just a nod to all of the great hard boppers. I think it's relevant, but I still am heavily influenced by that music. So, you know, there's little kind of strains of that still weaving through the music, you know.
Yeah.
The way I write the horns, arrange the horns, some sections in some tunes, you know, I still think, still a sort of shout out to that period of music, which was just incredible. And I think most contemporary jazz musicians, if they weren't influenced by that period of music, then I'm really not sure what they were influenced by.
That's right.
You know,
that's exactly right. Jason Brewer, I wanted to just quickly chat about the lineup. It's changed a little bit over the years. Now, I think you were in the last album, the trumpet chair was being shared by Cam McAllister and Simon Ferenczi. Now, Simon takes over that fully now in the trumpet chair, but Andrew Robertson, the saxophone player, also picks up the baritone for this album.
Correct.
Yeah. Mm. So tell us how you sort of, what your thinking was in terms of bringing that. I noticed, too, he's playing a little bit more flute than what he...
Yeah, look, I've written a couple of... There's three tunes on the album that is got a sort of flute lead on it. He plays baritone on this kind of funky blues that I wrote called Some Monk Funk, which is a bit of a nod to the great Thelonious, loosely. It's a sort of contrapuntal line between the rhythm section and the horns. And then I thought it'd sound really great to have the baritone playing with the rhythm section, you know, as well as, you know, to have that extra punch. Mm. And then, of course, you know, if we're going to have him playing in the melody, you know, we've got to get him to do a solo. Because Andrew played baritone on a track on Mosaic, our first album, on my arrangement of Sham Time, which was an Eddie Harris song.
Right.
And he just sounds so great. You know, I mean, Andrew sounds great on anything, but like he's just got such a good sound on baritone. So I thought, right, I've got to have him on one track on baritone.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you now about the challenges that COVID has brought. I mean, you've had your own challenges, obviously, with COVID and long COVID.
Mm.
But what do you see as the biggest shifts in the live music scene since COVID?
Look, it's made an incredible comeback, Frank, to be honest. Like, it's hard to believe that even a year ago we're sort of like being anxious about tours that were coming up and stuff like that. Like, you know, I was involved, you know, when I got really sick with COVID, I obviously had to cancel a lot of work, but one of the bands that I was in had a couple of tours cancelled, very late notice. And, you know, I've known numerous other artists and bands that suffered the same fate. But it's like, if you were asleep for the last 2 years and you woke up now, you'd have no clue, because there's so many gigs going on at the moment in Sydney. Like, it's incredible.
Yeah,
you know, like any night of the week there's something on. There's a lot of little clubs opening up, clubs I still haven't even been out to see. You know, there's a warehouse in Marrickville doing something on a Wednesday night that's, you know, a bit hush-hush, but that's apparently packed with 19-year-olds listening to straight-ahead jazz. It's just got, a sax player called Tim Novak. I think it's Tim Novak. Young guy. I think he runs that band.
Right.
And that's really happening. And then there's this little gig in Redfern called The Dock, and then there's Butcher's Brew and Lazy Bones and Django and Camelot, and, you know, all of those
Inner West
Gasoline Pony, you know, like, yeah. And it you know, also the sort of the more the like, I play in a Motown show called Dancing in the Shadows of Motown, and, you know, we tour all over the country and play in theaters, and, you know, crowds are coming back in their droves, you know. Yeah, I think that sort of 2 years, 2.5 years had a really bad effect on people. Those sort of people that go out anyway. People that are stay at homes, they probably wouldn't have noticed that much difference.
Mm.
But for a lot of people, they have to go out at least once or twice a week to see music.
I think it's just created this vacuum, and now we're seeing the initial effects of that, where people have just, as you say, they're keen to get out, experience the live music
exactly.
again. And I've noticed it in the gig guide. Gig guide's getting longer and longer every week. So.
Yeah, well, that's good to see. You know, the only thing I would say with that, excuse me, is that especially for sort of midweek gigs, it's still a challenge to get a crowd because there is now so many options. There's also Miss Celia's in Asheville. That's got music virtually every night of the week now, I think Tuesday to Sunday. Because there's so many venues now, there's still the same amount of people to go out.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, on any given Wednesday, like, you know, I've been doing once a month on a Wednesday with Hammerhead at Lazy Bones for 9 years now. And, you know, it's still hit and miss because people are faced with so many options. They go, wow, what should we do on Wednesday night? They go, well, we could do that. We could go there. We could go there. Oh, we saw Hammerhead a couple of months ago, so we'll go and see somebody else. That's cool. But it does mean that, you know, we often still play to small crowds.
Let's go out tonight with Blues for Shemp. Now, Shemp, I think, was one of the Three Stooges.
He was the fourth Stooge, in fact.
Was he? Yes. Okay. And I think he was sort of renowned for not sticking to the script. So, I mean, that's perfect for jazz, isn't it?
Absolutely.
But tell us a little bit about Blues for Shemp.
Blues for Shemp is a sort of my take on that classic sort of blue note, you know, Eddie Harris, Les McCann, kind of cross-stick sort of soul funk, you know, which is just so infectious. You know, you've got those classic Eddie Harris tunes, Freedom Jazz Dance and Sham Tout Time and, you know, numerous others with that, just that groove that is just wonderful. You know, you could listen to it all day. So I thought, I don't know, I was just mucking about and, you know, something flew out and I thought, oh, wow, okay. And it's got a few twists and turns in it, which often my tunes do. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's got that sort of infectious groove. And
well, it's got the energy. And I, if you're on social media, from time to time, I see your feed come up and there's footage of you racing out onto the Manly Jazz Festival Oceanfront Stage, which is you're probably one of the last bands that will ever play on that one, given the Manly Council's decision. But let's not go there.
No.
But the footage of you racing with your band, racing out onto the stage, it's got that intensity about it. It's got that energy. And that's what I love about this album. It's so, just so great that an album like this can still be put out here in Australia. And do yourself a favour, as Molly would say. Hammerhead is the name of the band. I Didn't Get to Where I Am Today is the name of the album. Jason Brewer, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure, Frank. Thank you.